Hello, I'm Laura McKenzie from CHLY 11.7 FM in beautiful Nanaimo, BC. And you're listening to The Scoop, a regional news podcast highlighting weekly stories from BC's participating local journalism initiative radio stations.
Here's today's scoop for the week of May 26th to the 30th. CJSF's Danny Nesvedrani is with a team of researchers at Simon Fraser University who are celebrating a major development in their gene editing project. Sounds delicious? Well, it is. They grew berries. The city of Prince George signed on to a statement of support for the Human Trafficking Prevention Network of British Columbia, marking the city's commitment to fighting this ongoing issue. Ian Gregg is on the scoop for CFUR. The town of Smithers and a number of regional partners of the Bulkley-Nechaco area participated in one of the North's biggest simulated mass casualty events last Friday. CICK News has the scoop. And we begin today with a story from Heather Watson at CJLY about a crisis response team expanding to the Comox Valley. That's today's scoop. And if you want to listen to the full story on any of these scoops, visit frequencynews.ca.
This is a CHLY and CVOX news update. On Tuesday, May 20th, BC's Minister of Health, Josie Osborne, formally announced the Crisis Response Community-Led Team, or CIRCLE, expanding to the Comox Valley. Minister Osborne was joined at the press conference in Sims Millennium Park in Courtney by Comox Elder Fernanda Pere, Comox Chief Nicole Rempel, CEO of the Canadian Mental Health Association, or CMHA's, BC Division, Jonathan Morris, and AVI Health and Community Services Program Coordinator, Nicole Morrison.
Working in partnership with the Comox First Nation, AVI Health and Community Services, and the Canadian Mental Health Association BC Division, I am really honored to be here today with everybody to formally announce the Comox Valley Circle, or Crisis Response Community-Led Team, that is established, that is here, that is working and is serving people in the Comox Valley.
In her announcement, the health minister acknowledged this increase in complex mental health issues and substance use challenges throughout the province and expressed how everyone, including people with mental health and addictions challenges, deserves to feel safe in their own neighborhoods and communities.
By combining the clinical expertise of people together with the knowledge of people who've lived through similar experiences, this is a community-led approach that offers a more empathetic and effective response that can make a real difference in somebody's path to recovery.
Osborne described the service as helping people in crisis get timely and compassionate support from people who truly understand their experience.
And this might include those who are experiencing thoughts of suicide or self-harm, feelings of grief and panic and anxiety, or acting and feeling in ways that is distressing. And the CIRCLE team helps to de-escalate the situation, ensures and plans for the safety of the person in crisis, and connects them to services that support their longer-term needs.
Formerly known as Peer Assisted Care Team, or PACT, CIRCLE started in January of 2023 in North Vancouver and has since expanded to 5 communities. Locally, the program soft-launched in October 2024, servicing the Comox First Nation, and expanded in December to include all people living in the Comox Valley. Comox Chief Nicole Rempel spoke to the importance of CIRCLE partnering with Comox First Nation, and not only being community-led, but Indigenous-led as well.
Indigenous communities have lost too many of our people, too many lives taken by trauma, addiction, and systems that were never built with us in mind. Our communities have been grieving, our communities have been asking for help, but too often we are met with silence, delays, or responses that do more harm than good. Mental health crises should never be treated as crimes. And yet, for Indigenous people, especially those who are visibly Indigenous, the response we receive is not care, and we are often left more vulnerable. There's a deep and dangerous gap in mental health crisis response for all those suffering, especially in the space between hospitals and law enforcement, and that gap continues to cost lives. But today, I am proud to say that Comox is taking action. Through this CIRCLE program, we are piloting a new community-led approach to Indigenous mental health support, one that is trauma-informed, culturally grounded, and rooted in the strength and wisdom already present in our communities. This is not about ticking boxes. This is about culture, about connection, about compassion. For Comox, this is not just a pilot program. It is a process of decolonization. We are dismantling structures that have failed us, and we are replacing them with Indigenous-led systems of healing, care, and community support. This is about aunties showing up with medicine. It's about creating space for people to heal. It's about making sure that those doing the work, our frontline responders, are supported, valued, and protected in turn. As part of the Circle Initiative, Comox First Nation responders carry trauma-informed backpacks. These carry cedar, tobacco, Devil's Club, which are grounding tools for Indigenous people navigating the pain of trauma. These items are not symbolic, they are medicine. They are cultural anchors and they are care. This is how we reclaim care, by building systems that our communities can trust. Systems that other nations can learn from, adapt, and build upon. It is a path forward. To ensure this work is led with care, we are establishing a Comox Advisory Committee to guide the Circle program, making sure everything we do is trauma-informed, culturally safe, and rooted in reconciliation. This advisory body will bring Comox voices directly into the process and shape policies aligned with our values and our living realities.
The heavy emotion and significance of Chief Rempel's speech was felt and echoed by Minister Josie Osborne and the other speakers, who recognized the hurt done to Indigenous peoples and thanked Chief Rempel and Comox First Nation for partnering in this project. For CHLY and CVOX News, this is Heather Watson.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. On Friday, May 16th, the City of Prince George's mayor, a number of city councillors, Prince George Caribou MLA Kyle Giddens, and some community partners, in alignment with Victims and Survivors of Crime Week, signed a statement of support for the Human Trafficking Prevention Network. This symbolic gesture has been in the making for some time, with the Standing Committee on Intergovernmental Affairs requesting and receiving reports detailing information and actions municipalities can take to deal with human trafficking. Prince George joins over 20 other entities and organizations as a signer on the document, a statement of support for the Human Trafficking Prevention Network in British Columbia. The document was initiated by Lieutenant Governor of British Columbia, the Honorable Janet Austin, who is an honorary patron of the Human Trafficking Prevention Network. A number of corporations have also signed on, including Shell, TransLink, KPMG, Ocean Spray, The Juice Company, that's right, TELUS Health, Royal Bank of Canada, BC Lions, to name a few. But the City of Prince George is the first municipality to endorse this statement of support. Here's Mayor Simon Yu.
As we recognize the Victims and Survivors of Crime Week, we take the meaningful step towards this very serious issue together. I'm proud to share that the City of Prince George is the very first local government in BC to sign the statement of support for Human Trafficking Prevention Network.
One of the Prince George City Councillors who was identified by the mayor as being central to bringing this issue forward was Garth Frizzell. We caught up with him just after the signing.
Why is this important to you? Why is it important to connect these various organizations in town and also to, you know, the greater network of people trying to address this issue?
One of the benefits of being on council is you get invited to tour different facilities. And about a year and a half ago, we got invited to come and see what this Prince George Sexual Assault Center was like. And while we were there, we talked to the workers and heard personal stories. And it outraged and it hurt just the scale and the size of it. It's something that you don't know until you actually experience. And that stuck. And a few months later, we were at the UBCM conference where we saw books about how municipalities can help fight human trafficking. Councillor Clausen brought that to the Intergovernmental Affairs and said, what can we do? And we said, let's look into that. First, we did a declaration calling on the government to declare intimate partner violence an epidemic, much like you've seen all through Ontario. But today, Prince George was recognized as the first city, the first local government anywhere to join that network.
You mentioned what some local governments can do to make a difference. What can individuals do? What can the citizens of Prince George do to get involved to make this issue more apparent for those who aren't aware of it and to actually address it to prevent it from happening?
Just sending a note to a local elected official, or, you know, we had Emily Giddens here as well, send it to your MLA saying this is unacceptable, this shouldn't stop, and I'm on side with stopping human trafficking. That's a great start. There's lots of sites out there, websites that help identify, help you as you're passing through your normal day, see when there's a problem, identify it, and who you can contact.
One of the organizations doing the critical work Mayor Simon Yu praised in his address was the PGSA, or Prince George Sexual Assault Center. Executive Director Linnell Halakowski sat down with us at their downtown location.
As you're aware, the City of Prince George just signed a statement of support for the Human Trafficking Prevention Network, British Columbia. Is this a meaningful step in the bigger picture?
So, yes, I'm happy to see the document, because it does bring the issue, I think, forward to folks that might not, you know, typically think about this issue. And I think folks really don't know that this is happening in their town. And it certainly is. The Prince George Sexual Assault Center has been part of the Canadian Human Trafficking Network for many years. And we've responded so that it works as folks call in from across the country. And we've gotten calls to address, for us, it's been women who've been trafficked, but certainly men are trafficked, sex trafficked specifically. And we've left Prince George and gone to all sorts of different places to go pick women up and bring them back to Prince George and offer safety and support services. And then often we end up sending them down to Vancouver to larger centers. So a shout out to the Canadian Human Trafficking Network, because they have also been doing this work for a long time.
That's Linnell Halakowski, Executive Director of the PGSA, or Prince George Sexual Assault Center, on the presence of human trafficking in our community of Prince George, Claylie-Tanay. To find out more or to book a training session for yourself, your class, or your staff, visit pgsac.org. Also, to report an incidence of sexual assault, please call
1-866-212-5780, and that's 24/7. For someone who's been impacted by sexual assault within the last 72 hours.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
This is CICK News.
Was Chelsea on the plane? Was she on the plane? I don't know what's going on. I don't know. All I need to know, did she make the plane?
Today on CICK News, the town of Smithers conducted a wide-ranging training exercise on Friday, May 23rd at the Smithers Regional Airport, hospital, and a number of emergency response crews, organizations, and regional systems for dealing with a mass casualty event were involved. The training was designed to develop frontline response capabilities and the coordination of a simulated EOC, or Emergency Operations Center. A warning to our listeners, some of the audio that you will hear are the screams of the passengers on the aircraft at the site of the crash. These are students who are enrolled in a pre-health class who are acting like they have survived a crash. No one was actually harmed.
So we're here at the airport for a mass casualty training exercise. And I have a role here today as a local media person, but I'm going to pretend like I know somebody on board when I really don't.
Have you participated in one of these before?
I have not. I'm really excited. And I heard that they're just putting the makeup on the teenagers because they're going to make them look very broken.
After speaking with emergency support services crew who were excited to play their roles, I caught up with two men from Northern Health with an interesting role to play in this interprofessional exercise to help simulate a lifelike scenario of a mass casualty incident to ensure everyone's ready when disaster strikes.
Okay, so I'm the regional manager for Northern Clinical Simulations. We work with the education team. Our primary task is to simulate the real-life situations. Code Orange is one of those, like, which we are practicing today.
And Code Orange is?
Code Orange is massive casualty.
Okay, and you're adding blood. I heard you say that we needed more blood there. Yeah. What is this?
This is simulated blood. It is made with a special blood powder, which is specifically created for simulations, which is added with some water and some alcohol. Mm-hmm. Creates a blood-like consistency. So there are many kind of people here.
I tagged along on paramedic and teacher Matt Anderson's tour of the scene. He was there with his EMR class from Kiawaget in Whitsett, where we surveyed the scene as he pointed out some of the reasoning behind how passengers were being treated and in which order.
See there, you got a red tag. Look on her wrist. See the red tag? Critical. Critical. So she needs help. red tag on her wrist. He's checking her breathing right away. And I'll get into it more with you guys, but if their RESPs are below a certain level and their LOCs below a certain level, they would be, well, you tag them black, right? You tag a black and they're dying. And I know it's harsh, but like you go after reds and you leave the other ones.
After the airport, we drove to the hospital where we met with Northern Health's Health Services Administrator Cormac Hickish, who gave our small group of town councillors, MLAs, ambulance drivers, and others a tour of the simulated emergency response in the Smithers Hospital in case of an emergency. The hospital was taking the emergency preparedness very seriously, practicing real-time decision-making and logistical adjustments in a high-pressure, realistic scenario. Our tour gave us a behind-the-scenes look at how staff adapt and operate during a simulated chemical emergency, as well as mass casualty incident. Staff were not pre-briefed on the exact scenario, so they had to pivot in real time, as it would happen in an actual emergency.
When the call came through to ER, we do have some Code Orange resources. You see, that's where the vests come from, etc. There's signage. And so what we end up doing, the ambulance bays are actually the other side, as you might recall. So whether you're a real walk-in patient, or you're a bystander, or you're part of the exercise, you all come through the same.
Mike Andrews is a principal at GetSet Solutions, a Vancouver-based firm that trains people in emergency management. They were the firm hired to run the EOC, or Emergency Operations Center, for this simulation.
See this running part of this exercise. Part of it was designed by the town of Smithers, and this is the second year we've come here. So this is part of a progression of emergency management training and exercises that the town has been undertaking in an effort to build more and more resiliency. So this is what we call an emergency operations center, or an EOC, and this is a whole of jurisdiction or whole of agency mechanism for dealing with an emergency situation. We're not managing the emergency from here. At the incident site, they're managing it. So the coordination of all of those happens out of here. Operations here are fire department, police, BC Wildfire, BC Ambulance. They are senior representatives of those departments and agencies that are out there doing stuff. This is a very mature program here, and they're doing a good job.
Matt Herzog, Deputy Fire Chief for Smithers Fire Rescue. So this was one of the largest exercise of this kind in the north, and the reason for that is that we've got a live exercise happening on the ground with unifying command and multiple different agencies involved from across the north. We also have a Code Orange happening at the hospital, Buckle Valley District Hospital, and an emergency operations center stood up at the Christian Reformed Church.
Is this feeling accurate for response times from the fire department, paramedics?
For the Smithers response, yes, it's very accurate. We had everyone staged already just to kind of help this move along. Otherwise, we'd be looking at multiple hours of response times for support from those other communities.
Yeah. What's the result of this?
This is one of the most accurate things that we can do for our responders to get as many responders involved.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, no worries.
My name is Samantha Labaugh. I am the Communications and Engagement Officer with the Town of Smithers.
Okay, so it seems like we're sort of rounding up the day here. We started at the airport, hospital, and now in the EOC here. So how do you think it went?
I think it went really well. We had a really good coordinated response with regional partners all the way from Houston, Whitsett.
What about for the people of Smithers if there was a real mass casualty incident?
Yeah.
I mean, people in this town, first off, news spreads really fast. Well, gossip can also spread very fast.
Yeah.
What do you think as communications for the town, what are you taking away from this as a way to most effectively kind of get the right information out as quickly as you can?
Yeah, so the key is to get the information out first and be credible. So it's really important to follow official information. And, you know, you will see things on social media, rumors that will fly pretty fast. But it's important to always follow the RCMP's direction, the ambulance direction, as well as official sources like the Town of Smithers or the highways, anything like that. Follow official information sources only.
A big thank you to all the crews and agencies involved in the Town of Smithers emergency response training exercise, which was one of the largest in Northern BC's history. It brought together more than 150 emergency personnel from across the region. The training was funded through the Union of BC Municipalities, or UBCM Community Emergency Preparedness Fund. CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. A team of researchers at Simon Fraser University, led by Professor of Plant Functional Genomics, Jim Mattson, has successfully grown both blueberry and raspberry crops in the university's biotech greenhouse during the winter. CJSF recently took a trip down to the research team's lab, where Jim Mattson gave us a tour of not only the lab facilities, but the biotech greenhouse as well.
Yeah, and this western red cedar was a very nice tree until a few years ago, and it died from repeated drought stress in the summer. And that's happening all over the campus. Western red cedar is quite drought sensitive. So that's climate change. And it's actually well on the way for agriculture too, that you need to adjust varieties based on climate change.
So this is the greenhouse. Always quite messy. And also quite hot. Let's see how hot it is.
The next year, do you foresee this just improving and getting better?
Yes, but we're not doing it here. We're doing it primarily in Chilliwack, and where we have a larger greenhouse. It's highly controlled. We measure all the inputs. We measure the amount of electricity, the amount of natural gas used for heating, and so on, to find out a good compromise, I should say, between growth and cost of producing. So in the end, it's not just science. You have to make it commercially feasible too. Otherwise, it's not going to be used by anyone, so to say.
Another question we had for Mattson was, what was contributing to this project's success? Why were they seeing progress in indoor berry growing that hadn't been seen before?
I think the gene editing is a big part, because it's really hard to change in a short time traits in perennial species in particular. They take years to. It usually takes something like 10 to 20 years to make a new variety, and the changes are usually incremental. And blueberry in particular is really hard, because it has four copies of each gene. And for some traits, you need to knock out not just one copy, but all four. And that can never be done, it's very difficult to do that by traditional breeding, especially since no one knows what gene to look at that happens. So we can do it in a controlled way without changing anything else in the genome, just changing that gene. So that's a big change. That's a revolution, I think, in agriculture, the gene editing. They will not... So transgenics are highly controversial, even though it has been shown that it is safe and it's too expensive. So it's only the big companies that can pursue them right now. It costs many, many millions, actually tens of millions, to get new varieties approved that are transgenic. So this is sort of the opportunity for breeders of all breeds and species to do something. So it's quite a change. It's not just the big crops like maize and rice and wheat. It's other crops that can be bred in a fairly short time for particular traits without changing the whole genome, so to say, mixing up the whole genome. So that's a big change.
He then went on to explain the mechanisms behind the berry growing process.
So we did a test this winter with both raspberry and blueberry, primarily blueberry, but raspberry as well, and it worked out surprisingly well. So blueberry, normally they make the flower buds in the late summer, when days are getting shorter and the nights are getting cooler. Then the plant get the signal that it's time to make flower buds, but then they go dormant from the same treatments. When it gets cooler and shorter day, after a while they go dormant, and then they stay dormant until the spring, until about March, April, when the longer days and warmer temperatures make them wake up and start growing again. So the problem is, if you then want to grow them in winter time, you want to induce flower bud formation, but you do not want them to go dormant. Because if they go dormant, they're going to stay, it doesn't matter if you put light on them and high temperature, they're not going to do anything for a few months. So they need a specific time of cold treatment before they start growing again. But if you time it correctly, you can induce flower buds, but they do not go dormant. And that's what we did with the blueberry in the fall. So we took them inside before they went dormant, and then they started growing in the first one already in September, and we had the first crop in December, with the peak of the crop in January and February.
During our conversation, Mattson also stressed the potential that this project has to progress Canada's domestic agriculture.
Well, we got a grant from the Weston Family Foundation, which is tied, of course, to the Loblaws and so on. They are the owners, Weston is the owners of Loblaws and so on. And what happened a few years ago during COVID, there was problems with import because of the COVID crisis. And this company and other companies and consumers realized that, hey, there can be big disruptions in import of produce, including berries, not just berries, but other too, during events of COVID. And of course now with Trump and his activities, then it's entirely possible that these things will be more expensive too. So it's good to have a domestic production.
Well, there is still much more work that needs to be done to make these berries viable for commercial production. Jim Mattson and his research team are optimistic of the project's future outcomes. Once again, this has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.